This is Susan Schwartz, June 6, 1992. The Handless Maiden, Betrayal of and by the Father. Now this is the lecture, so it's tape 1 of 4. And then following this are 3 tapes of workshop.
Friday, June 5, 1992. Susan Schwartz, PhD, speaks for the Jung Society, Seattle. On the Handless Maiden Fairy Tale. While this tale speaks eloquently to the wounds that befall women, it also speaks to the need for recovery of the feminine principle for both men and women.
As an old man for offered riches, you know, you might even think about it. If somebody came up to you and you were poor and your mill was not doing well and he looked like an old man, you would probably sign on the dotted line. But I think, again, the beauty of fairy tales is they really tell us how we should act in our life. So as we listen to the fairy tale, think of all of the kind of warnings that are given about how to act and what to do psychologically, actually inside and outside of ourselves. As we look closer at the meaning of this setting, the mill symbolizes many things. It is the female organ of generativity, as well as fate and death. These attributes encompass the spectrum of the archetype of the terrible mother who is able to inhibit growth. In Indian mythology, the mill is a symbol of the negative wheel of life in kind of an aimless circling around, which is getting nowhere, called samsara. In Greek mythology, Apollo and Zeus were millers who presided over the creative, life-giving principle for the propagation of all creatures. These various meanings of the symbol are significant as they are precursors to the complexes and the archetypes which are going to unfold throughout the fairy tale. The opening situation describes a material poverty, but actually represents a lack of the feminine or inner anima connection of the father. For the daughter, the poverty means she has not been sufficiently nourished by the eros or inner sense of psychological relatedness from the father. You know, I think one of the ways that understanding of a fairy tale really comes alive is if you personalize it. That's why it's written in archetypal language. We don't know, there are no names here, but if you personalize it and bring it inside and think about yourself as this daughter or as this father or daughters and fathers and where they are inside of you and what your own personal experience has been, I think it will bring it a little closer inside to your heart. Yes? Aha. All right. So this is once more, we get a redoing of it for the tape, right? Okay. A certain miller had little by little fallen into poverty and had nothing left but his mill and a large apple tree behind it. Once when he had gone into the forest to fetch wood, an old man stepped up to him, whom he had never seen before, and said, "Why do you plague yourself with cutting wood? I will make you rich if you promise me what is standing behind your mill." "What can that be but my apple tree?" thought the miller, and said yes, and gave a written promise to the stranger. He, however, laughed mockingly and said, "When 3 years have passed, I will come and carry away what belongs to me." And then he went. When the miller got home, his wife came to meet him and said, "Tell me, miller, from whence comes this sudden wealth into our house?" All at once, every box and chest was filled. No one brought it in, and I know not how it happened. He answered, "It comes from a stranger who met me in the forest and promised me great treasure. I, in return, have promised him what stands behind the mill. We can very well give him the big apple tree for it." "Ah, husband," said the terrified wife, "that must have been the devil. He did not mean the apple tree, but our daughter, who was standing behind the mill, sweeping the yard." All right. So let me give you an example in real life of how this fairy tale might be worked out. A woman named Jeannie, who is not her real name, at the age of 12 or so, went on a walk with her father. The walk was designated as significant because he was supposed to tell her something. She imagined that it would be that she was illegitimate, would be sent away, her parents were divorcing, or maybe these were not even her real parents. In fact, she wasn't told anything, and the walk ended with as little communication as it began. She was terribly disappointed and deeply hurt, for she had gotten less than nothing from her father, and he had not even addressed her during the entire walk. From that time on, she resolved to separate emotionally from her parents and became secretly depressed and anorexic. In psychologically severing from her parents, she did to herself exactly what she had expected from her father, and in reaction erected a solitary world cut off from others. You notice this is exactly what the unconscious aspect of the father can do. The tale in this example reveals the betrayal by the father as a hurt which forces the opening to self-discovery and eventuates necessary movement away from home. In early versions of this fairy tale, the girl leaves because her father demands her hand in marriage, showing the underlying motif of psychological incest which he has laid upon her. And in fact, this fairy tale and one that I will bring up tomorrow are two that are very well noted to be fairy tales depicting incest. Such a connection contaminates and produces absolutely no growth or birth, but a tremendous stagnation. Moreover, the lack of involvement of the mother in the tale forces the girl to assume responsibility for herself without the assistance of maternal protection. You notice that the mother knew who was behind, that it was the daughter, that it was not just this apple tree, and yet she really didn't do anything. The betrayals are painful wrenchings out of the originally unconscious and therefore very dangerous psychological situations. They are typical of the psychological or actual incestuous family constellation and demonstrate the danger in being held captive in what Jung calls a participation mystique of the family and the necessary journey to find oneself beyond the confines of the family circle. I don't know if you're familiar with that term, but participation mystique is exactly what you might understand. One is just mysteriously held in by the family and unconscious as to what is going on, why, what one's place is, etc. When the father figure has no limits himself and is either all-giving or a rigid disciplinarian, encased in a distant and foreboding authority structure, the girl cannot be personally touched by the animus or masculine principle which should be originating from the actual father. It is damaging psychologically if the daughter cannot get close enough to him to learn about healthy masculine energy. She can know how the masculine feels only with a personal experience of emotional closeness and relatedness. But when this is absent, or when the father is physically unavailable, a vacuous space is created, which naturally will seek to be filled. But too often, it becomes filled with an unnatural masculine principle. Due to his absence, the father or masculine image is either made up or derived from that of the mother. And the animus then, the male part of the woman, is modeled on what the feminine would imagine the masculine to be. That's not what it really is. That is what the feminine imagines the masculine to be. In either instance, it is distorted because the feminine out of itself cannot develop an accurate impression of the masculine. And that inner masculine element, the animus, is unbalanced in either being too cold, too negative, too passive, or too wonderful, and overlaid in all these instances with a sense of unreality. The animus actually should be and is a life giver, But when there is a doubting of feminine instinct, it turns negative. I will give you an example of this negative possession from another woman, a dream that she had. And it went like this. A man wanted to marry me. He was Spanish and dark-looking, with matador-type clothes. He was attracting me, but I did not want him to know that, as I felt a very strong pull towards him and also away from him. He attended my wedding and knew that I was married, but he still persisted. He was rich, and his family owned this huge western town. They kept adding to it. Each time I saw him, he looked more Spanish and less attractive to me. At one point, he even got into bed with me. I was glad I had a nightgown and a shirt on. I said, "See how ugly I am with my hair a mess?" But as you can imagine, he didn't even care. So the male gets, and that was the end of the dream. You see, he'll go after no matter if you look like a mess or you have your lousy clothes on or you don't look so wonderful. He doesn't care. What he wants is to get you. The male gets more invasive and closer in this dream while she feels attraction to him, but she doesn't understand it. His darkness denotes an evil quality that she really cannot escape and which pulls her towards him against her will. She is drawn to what is fearful and to the energy which she has yet to recognize as her own. The undeveloped part of the personality will perversely acquire increasingly more power until it is eventually blown out of proportion. And of course, then we become conscious of it. Can I interrupt to ask what this little dot is that's happening here? Is that the end of the... Oh, I see. Excuse me, I'm sorry. All right. Okay. All right. As you can tell, I don't know much about mechanical whatevers. When a woman doesn't know her own power or her stance, she can be swept up by it in a way which leaves her possessed rather than possessing. Many educated and independently minded women become quite intrigued with a malevolent or invader male quality, which destructively turns against them inwardly, and they end up apologizing for their strength. And this indicates the conflict inherited through the generations of how to be a powerful and a feminine woman. I would just like to add here, how many of you have noted, or perhaps do yourself, at the end of every sentence asking a question mark? It really is a statement, but it's always ended with a question mark. And it is like, am I valid? Am I okay? Do I have a right? It implies a lot of that. As you become aware of it, I hope it will bother you so that you won't do it. Or your friends also. So the fairy tale and the dreams show that the understanding of feminine psychology brings attention to the animus in a woman's personality. I don't know if you've read Emma Jung on the anima and the animus, but she goes through four different aspects. And let me kind of go through them and see if you think that these apply now. Because, you know, the animus is going to change as we live in America, Seattle, wherever, and live in 1992 rather than when Emma Jung wrote this, 50-something, I think. So the first that she mentions of the animus is strength, which means consciousness and responsibility. The second is spirit, the creative, which requires separation from the father image. The third is meaning, which signifies a better relation to female aspects. And the last is deed, which is the integration of the animus with the female self. All these aspects are essential for a woman to know and be able to use, as the animus will direct attention towards the actuality of life. The animus signifies a woman's feeling relationship to man, to men in general, to culture, and to spiritual life. This is a quote, not from Emma Jung, but from Onions. It's another reference. If you want it, I will give it to you in the break. To contemplate some action is to have it in one's animus, to turn one's attention to something, an idea or an object in space, is to turn the animus towards it. When one loses consciousness, the animus leaves. Moreover, to collect one's faculties and spirits is to collect one's animus. Sounds very helpful. This word originally meant breath or spirit and connects a woman to the spiritual aspects of her psyche. Activating the masculine principle means to know one's goal and to do what is necessary to achieve it with courage, determination, force, and authority, and with the qualities which further a woman to be effective, powerful, and competent, but in a feminine way in the world. Not as a man, but as a woman. So let me read a little bit from the fairy tale here and see where we are. So the miller's daughter was, as many daughters and females are in fairy tales, beautiful and pious. And she lived through the 3 years in fear of God and without sin. When therefore the time was over and the day came when the evil one was to fetch her, she washed herself clean and made a circle around herself with chalk. Here's another helpful hint of what to do when there's danger. The devil appeared quite early, but he could not come near her. Angrily, he said to the miller, "Take all the water away from her, that she may no longer be able to wash herself, for otherwise I have no power over her." Another hint. If you're in the midst or around the devil, make sure you've got some water around you. The miller was afraid, and he did so. And the next morning, the devil came again, but she had wept on her hands, and they were quite clean. Again he could not get near her, and furiously said to the miller, "Cut her hands off, or else I have no power over her." The miller was shocked and answered, "How could I cut off my own child's hands?" Then the evil one threatened him and said, "If you do not do it, you are mine and I will take you myself, you yourself." The father became alarmed. And you know what? He promised to do it. So he went to the girl and he said, "My child, if I do not cut off both your hands, the devil will carry me away, and in my terror, I have promised to do it. Help me in my need and forgive me the harm that I do you." She replied, "Dear father, do with me what you will. I am your child." Thereupon, she laid down both her hands and let them be cut off. The devil came for the third time, but she had wept so long and so much on the stumps that after all, they were quite clean. And then he had to give in and had lost all right over her. It's appalling, this fairy tale, isn't it? Symbolically, it is appalling. What is also appalling is, do you remember in California several years ago, the man who cut off the 15-year-old girl's, the maiden's, both of her hands off? And you know, as a result, I don't know if you remember in the news, no town wanted him to live there. Thank goodness there was a bit of consciousness somewhere, huh? But I think also why I mentioned that is that, again, when things are not taken care of inwardly, they will jump outwardly and happen out in the world. So we want to take care of what's going on inside of ourselves. So this paragraph tells us that the devil, of course, has come to claim his property. The devil will never forget. And of course, she lived good, pious, and sinless in fear of God. And the sinless state denotes the traditional image and prescribed role of the docile female acting from the idea that being nice and good results in just treatment. But of course, all the goodness does not really help, because the state of sinlessness or denial of the shadow side of the personality means that one is not really living fully. The tale tells us that contrary to ideals imparted to girls as they grow up, merely being sweet is not sufficient when it comes to facing life. Initially, she keeps the devil away by washing herself clean. And the second day, she weeps so much that the devil is unable to get close to her. Von Franz refers to this saying, and I quote, "Crying is a way of dissolving the consciousness and getting closer to the unconscious. Crying affects an abaissement du niveau mental," another word that Jung, a phrase that Jung uses quite frequently. It's a lowering of consciousness through which the creative content of the unconscious can break through. The lowering of consciousness means letting go of control and opening to the forces beyond and larger than oneself. The beginning work in analysis is usually marked by a washing and cleansing over and over through the tears of despair. This provides purification and catharsis, constituting separation from previous ways of living. Preparatory transition to leave behind the old, mourning the loss, and making way for the new is part of the process of confronting one's individual character. The devil at the beginning and throughout represents a form of the animus, pushing the girl into the crisis, which puts her on the path of self-discovery. It seems as if the devil is holding the maiden back, or really harming her, which he does, but he really is part of her fate. And actually, as we look at the fairy tale, we might want to think, is he really a totally negative figure? Von Franz again notes that the demonic, which rests on unconscious forces of destruction, works with negative effect when the unconscious content of seemingly overwhelming intensity appears at the brink of consciousness. Holding one's ground against the power of the thrust of the complex develops consciousness for the ego to transform the demonic into the creative. That is the idea. Transform the demonic into the creative. The devil in the tale takes the posture of trying to get at the maiden, to capture her, and represents the extremely destructive aspect of the masculine energy. The very fact of the masculine taking the form of the devil shows how negatively powerful the animus becomes when there's been a lack of healthy connection with the father. And of course, that was our beginning paragraph, this lack of consciousness of the father towards the daughter. When the masculine principle is unknown, it becomes foreign and distant, and then over-exaggerated in reaction, manifesting as pressure, threatening to crush and smash at life. The immense anger at lack of attention to this part of the personality hits against the feminine to create such a conflictual situation that one is eventually and hopefully forced onto the path of self-examination. The devil in the fairy tale prods and persuades towards knowledge so that what first appears as evil provides the way into oneself. Were it not for the devil, the girl would remain within the family circle, and she might be unaware of the wider world. She would not take the journey to know her own ideas or herself as a separate entity. And through the gradual disidentification with the archetypal parental image, a person begins to develop an individual identity which is strong enough to break the spell of the patriarchal rule which has gripped the feminine for generations. Now, I don't mean the feminine just in women. I mean the feminine in everybody. And on the third day, when the crisis occurred, the lack of the father's appropriate feeling, I mean, it's not very appropriate, is it? He says, look it, you know, will you save me? Please, that's completely off. Or conscious awareness of her being allows the negative animus in the guise of the devil to attempt possession of the daughter. The father agrees, under the threat of being taken himself, to do the devil's bidding, and he cuts the maiden's hands off. The lack of consciousness of the father symbolizes a collective attitude that controls the feminine by cutting off her power and mutilating her. Once again, this is the feminine energy inside of everybody. We all live in a patriarchal culture, and how has it affected us? How has it cut off our hands? We might want to just think about. On the personal level, a father's attitude that controls and would sacrifice the feminine develops in the daughter the negative father complex, which subjects her to domination by destructive impulses. Do you ever wonder why you don't like yourself or are self-destructive? This might be one aspect of it. At this point in the story, and this is a quote from Karenyi, it is to the father then that the daughter falls victim, and he allows her to descend into the darkness. And it is the daughter who offers the sacrifice. You notice she said, okay. She descends into a paternal masculine darkness, the binding of the daughter to the father. That to which one succumbs and falls defenselessly always has a lethal aspect. The more so here, where the masculine appears not graciously and paternally, but very aggressively. The maiden daughter is obedient to her father, unprotected by her mother, and ignorant of her own life, as she allows the sacrifice of her body in order to save the father, a sacrifice which is active and passive on both of their parts. You know, they both play active and passive roles, both father and daughter. I think part of what I'm saying here is that the daughter also colludes. She does not say, I hate you, and run away. She doesn't kick him. She doesn't punch him. She does not rebel. She says, yes, go ahead and cut off my hand. So she is going along with the program, and hopefully we'll see that there might have been a reason for this. Being immersed in the negative father complex means that a woman cannot differentiate because the complex is too powerful and too threatening. She cannot yet differ with or leave the father because she has developed absolutely no self-definition. The maiden turns away from her identity due to insufficient self-worth and accommodates to this abusive father. She identifies with the aggressor father in repudiation of her life and succumbs to his control. A girl remains uncertain when she has not experienced her personality in relation to a secure masculine figure. This is not a very secure masculine figure, this father. So that when it comes to a situation which requires strength, persistence, perseverance, she capitulates exactly as her father did, because he modeled that for her. She has yet to discover that she does not need to give in to her father's orders, or even that she could refuse him. She cannot separate from that which she does not know. That's why she can't separate from it, because she doesn't know it. And her energy is sabotaged by a flattening and sickening spell of the negative father complex, keeping her psychologically bound and obstructed from emerging into life. The sorrow and shock of dismemberment causes us to consider the conscious and unconscious brutality done to the feminine principle through the ages, and the long process needed for its regeneration and healing. The brutality shows how much pain is required to awaken to oneself. For those who are very much cut off from themselves need a large shock to enter into life. In the tale, the cutting off of the daughter's hands is a castration, both to her femininity and to her masculinity, which in turn reinforces the domination by the destructive father complex. Disunion with oneself leads to a great deal of conflict, and the state of inner division causes an intense suffering. The father cuts off the hands of the daughter, signaling that he prefers to stay unconscious of her potential and her abilities, and relegates her to the role of a perpetual young daughter, who will remain passive and dependent on him because she has got no hands. I mean, she's got to stay with him is what it seems like. He diminishes her by not allowing growth, so he doesn't have to age and he doesn't have to be deposed from the power position. We could say that the father complex is predominant in this fairy tale as the part which wounds from its own intense woundedness. Follow me? It's the father who is also wounded, and that is why the father principle is also wounded. That's why he can wound so badly. Unconsciously, he is angry at her for having the qualities he senses will eventually surpass him. The father's envy toward her and the encouragement of dependency to feed his narcissistic needs infantilizes the daughter. The lack of the appropriate father connection for the girl leaves her ignorant of the world with no knowledge of how to unite with the masculine. I mean, who wants to unite with this kind of a father figure? She is too soft, malleable, and susceptible to danger from the masculine and cannot decide or know her own opinion and concedes without question. By not countering him, an internalized self-recrimination repeats the treatment she received at the hands of the father. So not only does he cut off her hands, but she learns how to treat herself in that very same destructive way. The creative energy lying behind the father complex of the girl unconsciously will grow larger the more that is repressed. She will eventually need to break out of this, surpass the father, a situation which is both desired and feared by the girl or woman who is bound to the negative father complex. Unless she breaks the power of this complex, she will continue the attachment through her anger and frustration, and a harsh and depressed woman will be the result. So let me go back to the fairy tale here. So after this father has cut off his daughter's hands, he says to her, "I have by means of you received such great wealth." Incidentally, you know, he cut off the hands not only so that the devil would not cut his off, but also so he would get great wealth. "I have by means of you received such great wealth that I will keep you most handsomely as long as you live." But she replied, "Here I cannot stay. I will go forth, and compassionate people will give me as I require." She then left and wandered into the great forest. Then she knelt down, called on God the Lord, and prayed. And suddenly an angel came towards her. She and the angel went into a royal garden, and she saw a tree covered with beautiful pears. She went to them, and to still her hunger, and at the instruction of the angel, she ate one with her mouth from the tree, but no more. Can you imagine how hard it is to eat with no hands? The king to whom the garden belonged came down to it next morning and counted the pears as he did daily and saw that one of the pears was missing. Quite a materialist, isn't he? One pear. The gardener told him that he had seen a ghost with a maiden the night before eating from the tree. And the king said, "I myself will watch tonight." When it grew dark, the king came into the garden and beneath the tree watched. At midnight, the maiden came creeping out of the thicket, went to the tree, and again ate one pear off of it with her mouth. Beside her stood the angel in white garments. Then the king went out to her and said, "Do you come from heaven or from earth? Are you a spirit or a human being?" She replied, "I am no spirit, but an unhappy mortal, deserted by all but God." And the king said, "If you are forsaken by all the world, yet will I not forsake you." He took her with him into his royal palace, and here we know again why the female gets anywhere. She was so beautiful and good. It's a little sarcasm, huh? He loved her with all his heart, had silver hands made for her, and took her to wife. I want you to notice that so far, we don't know if she wanted to marry him. It's not clear. He took her to wife, and she didn't really say anything. So we'll have to see what happens. Symbolically, the body reveals through the areas of pain what has been repressed and ignored. So we might say that the pain in the hands, or the pain in having the hands cut off, what do the hands represent? I'm going to go through a few symbols, but you think about your hands and how you use them, how important they are. Huh? We couldn't even run computers without our hands. Jung says, hands are ultimately connected to the psyche. One's attitude to oneself is revealed in one's hands. You might examine your own, too. They might reveal by their shape and functioning the psychic peculiarities of the individual and thus furnish eloquent and intelligible clues to character. In the fairy tale, an aspect of the unconscious is being expressed through the hands as a missing and yet to be developed element within the psyche. The hand as part of the body historically holds a great deal of importance, and the power attributed to the human hand is of ancient belief. The hand is defined as the chief instrument of all operations. It seizes, holds, is representative of a person in relation to action, ability, skill, activity. And if cut off, it means disunion or the loss of a friend. How closely connected then we must be to our hands. To the Hebrews, it was used for the bestowal of blessings and divine gifts. The hand was the seat of strength or life, and both were associated with the masculine seed. So here we have in the hands a representative of the male element. The ancient Jewish practice of giving the name hand to a stone set up for the dead was linked to its identification with the spirit, or the procreative life soul. To this day in the Jewish religion, the woman holds her hands over the Sabbath candles while praying, and men wrap a prayer box around the hand in their daily morning prayers. In this religion, the hands represent connection to the Spirit of God, but are not supposed to ever directly touch the sacred words of God in the Torah, which are supposed to represent a transcendence of the personal dimension. The fairy tale demonstrates the significance of hands cut off and how this suffering and wounding activates the healing power from within. Handlessness teaches patience, receptivity, obedience, and quiet. The handless situation represents the fact that only a portion of the psyche is known, but it's crippled, it's less than, and helplessly frustrated in being different from others. Likewise, to have hands that are too full is to be rendered handless, because one is engaged in a dither of activity, just running around aimlessly. For the outwardly active woman, being alone and isolated is very difficult, and sitting with herself means not occupying time with aimless busyness. Hands serve to touch the animus and feel its energy for focus and guidance, with a grip on the outer world in reflection of connection with the inner world. If the animus energy remains unharnessed, with nothing to hold on to, a woman has no way to organize her time. A woman like this could tend to remain in crises, so there's no space for herself, and she might even need to resist working for a time, so that she could, if that path leads away from, rather than towards a resolution of the problem. For her, hands can be used when she learns how to use them through the receptiveness gained from a gathering of energy without being pushed around by it, once again possessing rather than being possessed by. Disentanglement from the hold of the negative masculine requires hands that can operate competently to establish contact with the feminine self. In analysis, that this can be enacted through recording dreams, drawing, or any kind of creative work, as well as being silent. Really not getting into doing, but being. Modern women are raised to take care of their hands so they look untouched, smooth, and soft, with long nails, You know the long nails, right? Hands to look at and to admire. Such hands could represent a type of femininity which restricts accomplishment, productivity, or naturalness. I hope nobody will be offended here, but have you noticed that people, women, who have tremendously long nails have a great deal of difficulty handling change? They have a great deal of difficulty just handling, because these, you know, it's like you can't get close to anything because the nails are somehow in the way. And I wonder if that's kind of a cultural something that's being said to women. At the same time of women moving out into the world, then why be handicapped with nails that don't allow you to hold something? It's just my, you might think about if you agree or not. So this restriction of accomplishment, productivity, or naturalness leads one to imagine inner hands with nails that might claw inside, creating pain and distress from frustration and a constriction of talents. An example is a woman who liked to draw and said she was very good at it. However, she could never find the time, conveniently, to engage in this activity, actually fearing that the picture would not exactly show her feelings, or that she or the picture would not be completely understood. The few drawings which she executed during analysis were very sparsely drawn in pencil and lacking any indication of depth or color. I mean, she just couldn't get her hands into it. Large printed words were used to make sure that her feelings had become absolutely clear. The drawing showed her hesitancy to look at the inner emptiness, which really contributed to ignoring her own talents. The full expression of the personality from her hands was not allowed or cultivated, demonstrating quite graphically the psychological repression that she was experiencing. So after, in the fairy tale, after her hands are cut off, the maiden leaves home. It's very courageous, isn't it? Would you leave home without your hands? Think about it. It'd be hard. And she starts on this journey of having to fend for herself and find herself. The tasks that she has to go through, perhaps like tasks of initiation, sever her bond of unconscious identification with this aggressor father, who would otherwise suffocate and obstruct the process of her own growth. To stay with father would be to remain surrounded in the paternal world and amount to being trapped by the dictates of a negative father principle. The disappointment in father means a maiden must develop a father spirit from within herself. And Emma Jung says, when the discrimination between image and person sets in, we become aware that the man who seemed to embody our image does not now do so. The feminine element can only get into its right place by a detour that includes coming to terms with the masculine factor, which is the animus. And the first state is the withdrawal of the projection by recognizing it as such and thus freeing it from the object. And this is, of course, exactly what she's doing by leaving. And she says, I'm going to quote from Emma Jung again, what women have to overcome in relation to the animus is a lack of self-confidence and resistance of inertia. It is as if we have to lift ourselves up to a spiritual independence. Without this sort of revolt, no matter what she has to suffer as a consequence, she will never be free of the power of the tyrant and then never come to find herself. So the maiden departing from home starts this transition, like she's going through a rite of passage. And like all journeys, goes through a stage called liminality. Let me just describe the person in this stage, and I think she quite correlates with the maiden. The subject of ritual passage is in the liminal period, kind of an in-between period, structurally, if not physically, invisible. The transitional being or liminal persona at once is at the same time no longer classified and yet not yet classified. So what she was, she's no longer. What she's going to be, she has not yet become. The humility of being stripped during this period coincides with the trials and ordeals as one is rendered down to their basic self. Of course, the maiden not having her hands is rendered down to her basic self and quite in an outcast position during this time. Part of reaching the heights or the actualization of one's personality is a descent into the depths, reflecting the link between initiation and death in the psyche. Initiatory rituals trace rebirth from the old life to the new life and are followed by an increase in power of the initiate. And this period of liminality provides a time of inner observation and is a period of dissolution of the old order to reestablish new limits and new boundaries. It is a paradox of society, women, and the maiden stage of feminine development, which is depicted in this fairy tale. And I really think this liminal time relates to our own time in relation to the feminine, that we have come a certain distance, but I really question if we're still not in this betwixt and between period. The value of the state of liminality is that it recognizes life crises as very significant factors in the psychological and social development of a person. And then, of course, as the fairy tale says, after one day on her journey, the maiden prays to God and an angel appears. You know, if you read the fairy tale, God is usually, the fairy tales, God is usually mentioned, and it's kind of a sneak in to promote a certain spiritual element as well as to promote Christianity. The fairy tales were written the early 1800s, and there was an underlying message to be put forth. Praying to God represents an appeal to that which is larger than the ego and which must submit to the demands of the life force as to a divine being. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like it's too much and you have to give everything up and then to see what will happen for you. The maiden also tells us, don't be too proud to ask for help, and really demonstrates an ability to seek assistance. This is contrary to the notion that it must be done alone or that asking for help shows some kind of weakness. I think we all somehow learn that, and yet asking for help can be a wonderful and a beautiful way to get it. The angel who appears symbolizes the guiding force from the unconscious, bringing contents into consciousness through the flow of energy between the human and the transcendent, a form of energy which is also superior to the ego. The creativity inherent in the interaction between what has been and what will be is the territory mediated by angels, kind of a liminal place. And the angels signify a reality which is not physical, but they are a spirit which penetrates to the biological level of existence and brings enlightenment to one's mind. The fact that an angel is a nurturing guide who watches over the rebirth of the maiden shows the importance given to the feminine which is coming into existence. Angels don't just come for everybody. You know, there's something significant going on here. The maiden's growth is fostered and protected by the angel, who's a positive and nurturing feminine or mother spirit. You notice her mother didn't really help her out a lot, so she needed something from the feminine. And also in counteraction to the negative father complex, the angel is functioning here. Guidance for growth needs assistance from the feminine realm, and it definitely has been missed by this maiden. So the first night, she steals the pear, and Eliade mentions about this and says, primitives, when in a state of impurity or mourning, because she must be in a state of mourning psychologically, the loss of the hands and the loss of her past, the loss of the family, the loss of an ideal, which has really disappointed her. So the primitives, when in mourning, do not use their hands, especially for eating. Novices in initiation rites take food with their teeth, as the souls of the dead are believed to do. This represents an initiatory death. Any external sign of mutilation indicates death and also resurrection. The handless eating shows that a transformation of the maiden has taken place through stealing. You notice she does steal the pears, which is usually against the law, but here is compensatory for the previous sinless state and is another way of establishing separation from her former life. I don't know if you remember, but I had mentioned that you can't really get through life without your shadow. So you've got to have a little bit that's on the edge, and here she is stealing. This is a nourishing act for life and to save her life, and done under the guidance of the angel to satisfy a real need rather than to hide or deny herself. And then the second night, of course, she repeats the eating. Again, the angel is teaching her how to live in a different way than what she did before. The angel initiates the maiden to the process of rebirth because the maiden on her own couldn't do this. One cannot proceed to a new stage of life unless, and here the maiden shows this, one returns to an infant condition in order to reclaim the basics. Meanwhile, the king has observed her eating in the garden, becomes her savior, protector, they wed, and he has silver hands made, which symbolizes their union. And the silver shows there's been a certain amount of progress and an intermediate solution is at hand. Silver represents the presence of the feminine aspect in its virginal sense. It has medicinal qualities and is associated with birth and human knowledge. So there's no chance that he chose silver. At this stage, it would seem like the work is complete, and she seems saved. I mean, after all, she marries a king. What else do you want? If you don't have your hands, maybe it's no big deal, but it is, of course. However, it's not the end, but rather a juncture in the process of psychological development. The silver hands cannot be the final answer because they are given by the king to the maiden rather than being created from within her own nature. That's the difference. The king, as the bearer of the ultimate power, represents a collective, dominating, masculine attitude and a governing authority over the land. Although she can do the right thing by obeying him, it could be with a conformity devoid of an inner spontaneity unless her own eros becomes personally enlivened. What cannot be produced by spontaneity is in danger of being brought about by force of will, and feminine naturalness would be subject to the dictates of the collective rule of the male, and then what would have happened? Nothing, except she just had her hands cut off, and she has silver hands, and she marries a king, but basically the whole psychological situation would not have changed. Many women and their femininity are caught in this stage so that they may adopt the attitudes and way of life of a man or be successful in a man's world, but they are actually subservient to the male and really feel secondary in society. They are run by the patriarchy, and the values of the masculine are followed at the expense of the feminine when performing in an approved way is given preference over being real. A woman cannot be truly independent if she operates under the throes of the masculine or at the mercy of the ideals, which could be dictated by an outer and inner male figures. This makes a woman hard, dissatisfied, and quite unrelated. And in reaction, there is a desire to rebel because the truth of her essence is going unrecognized by those around her and most especially by herself. Reclaiming the feminine is done by breaking out of the mold created by others and into a pattern designed by herself, tailored to her own needs as she takes responsibility for listening to her own inner voice. So let me go back to the fairy tale. Let me also say, I'm just going to finish, I have maybe, I don't know, 15 or so minutes, and then we'll take a break. Is that all right with you? If I just finish and then we... Okay. After a year, the king had to, if you remember, so he has the, she has the silver hands, and then after a year, the king had to go on a journey. So he commended his young queen to the care of his mother and said, if she's brought to childbed, take care of her, nurse her well, and tell me of it at once in a letter. Soon after, she gave birth to a fine boy. So the old mother made haste to write and announce the joyful news to the king. But the messenger rested by a brook on the way, as he was fatigued by the great distance. He then fell asleep. Then came the devil. You notice, you don't get rid of a devil easy. It's another lesson. Who was always seeking to injure the good queen, and exchanged the letter for another in which it was written that the queen had brought a monster into the world. You know, fairy tales are very interesting because the name has changed. She's not a maiden now. She has become a queen. So it's significant to watch this kind of shift that happens in the words of the fairy tale. When the king read the letter, he was shocked and much troubled. But he wrote an answer that they were to take great care of the queen and nurse her well until his arrival. The messenger went back with the letter, but rested at the same place and again fell asleep. How many times do we learn, right? We repeat the same thing over and over. Then the devil came once more and put a different letter in his pocket, in which it was written that they were to put the queen and her child to death. It's pretty serious. The old mother was terribly shocked when she received the letter and could not believe it. She wrote back again to the king, but received no other answer because each time the devil substituted a false letter. And in the last letter, it was also written that she was to preserve the queen's tongue and eyes as a token that she had obeyed. The tongue and eyes oftentimes in fairy tales are supposed to be preserved. I think it was, is it Snow White, who also had tongue and eyes. But the old mother wept to think such innocent blood was to be shed, and had a hind brought by night and cut out her tongue and eyes and kept them. And then said she to the queen, I cannot have you killed as the king demands, but here you may stay no longer. Go forth into the wide world with your child and never come here again. She has to leave once more. The old woman tied her child on her back and went away with eyes full of tears. The poor woman tied the child on her back and went away with eyes full of tears. She came into a great wild forest, and then she fell on her knees and prayed to God. The angel of the Lord appeared to her and led her to a little house, on which was a sign with the words, Here all dwell free. A snow-white maiden came out of the house and said, Welcome, Lady Queen, and conducted her inside. Then she unbound the little boy from her back and held him to her breast that he might feed, and laid him in a beautifully made little bed. Then said the poor woman, From whence do you know that I was a queen? The white maiden answered, I am an angel sent by God to watch over you and your child. The queen stayed 7 years in the little house and was well cared for, and by God's grace, because of her piety, her hands which had been cut off grew back once more. It's not the end of the fairy tale. Let me comment a little bit and then we'll read the ending. At this point, the maiden gives birth to the king's son, which represents a birth of the masculine spirit and shows the new life and future possibilities which have developed from her contact with the king. It's obviously been a good contact. However, because the devil is not easily avoided, we learn that he has manipulated and changed the letters. And of course, he's able to do this because the messenger carrying the letter fell asleep, quite like in the Greek myths, where two of the messengers fell asleep when they descended into Hades, and they grew fast to the rocks of the underworld because they failed to heed the warnings to not rest, no matter how tired they became. Sometimes we have to do that, you know. We're exhausted, and we still have to go on because it's dangerous to rest in this place. We have to get to this place, and then maybe we can rest. This example exemplifies the nature of the conscious mind, which is proceeding to the unknown regions of the psyche and can be overpowered by the forces of the unconscious, showing how tenacious is our resistance to change. The interference of the devil pushes onward the process of growth, and the return letter says, of course, that the maiden has to be sent away. Once again, there is a helpful yet a very painful betrayal and lack of protection by another mother figure who acts also under the orders of the masculine. Each betrayal has forced the maiden onto the path of self-discovery, and although her journey has already been very difficult, it requires more from her because she has more to learn. Those who have much potential for growth do not have an easy time and cannot escape the challenge of plumbing the depths of themselves and stretching the borders of their being. So when you are faced with it one more time, maybe it comes back to be dealt with, or it is difficult, or you're on a difficult path because you've got lots of potential that really needs to be developed through lots of work. It's kind of a positive take on it, but I think it's really true. Upon leaving the world of the king and all that he provided, the maiden goes to the forest and once again prays to God. And as before, the angel reappears. We might question, is it the same angel? I'm not quite sure. The hut is symbolic of a womb-like incubatory enclosure, and the forest is a place of healing in the unconscious. Nature is a source of strength, and the aloneness brings renewal and integration of that which resides internally. The time spent in the forest awakens the value of the inner world with a concentration of energy into oneself, and transformation is attained through a psychological release. Jung says the most decisive experience of all is to be done with oneself. One must be alone to find out what it is that supports when one can no longer support oneself. And the experience gives one an indestructible foundation. What the maiden does in the forest and the hut is unclear, and we have to use our imagination here. But certainly she raises her son. It's one thing that she does do. The question can be asked if anything needs to be accomplished and if the drive to achieve is even appropriate to this process. The amorphousness of what happens in the forest means that the time of isolation will really be very different for each person. Von Franz says, typically in feminine psychology, there is a motif of exclusion from life for a period of years. This is a time when the deep inner split is cured and inner problems are resolved. The unconscious is experienced as isolation, and afterwards comes a return to life. The search for the self begins with the experiences of solitude gleaned from the dark and alone places which contain healing wisdom. Introversion fosters psychological unity as instinctual energy becomes available for life, making it possible to build a more complete personality. The development of one's uniqueness requires a certain amount of isolation and aloneness to forge a differentiation from the pressure of the participation mystique, which I mentioned earlier, of the collective or of the family circle. Introversion gives a focus on oneself and creates energy to reach back to the feminine way, which has formerly been blocked by repression. The feminine style of ego consciousness is turning inward and opening to what has formerly been unconscious, and in the process, the center of energy shifts from the outer world and those relationships to the world within. In primitive communities, women are secluded during the menstrual cycle, and at these regular intervals, a woman is required to go away to be alone by herself. This time brings up the instinctual energy, which is necessary for life, and makes a space for listening to her voice. This isn't allowed in our society. We can't be less than strong 365 days a year. Taking the inner work seriously makes one receptive to the creative energy of the spirit, which transcends one's daily life. In many religions, introversion and aloneness are necessary as part of meeting the gods or to be initiated to the inward experience. At such time, aspects of life are discovered which are not necessarily rational nor entirely explainable, but which contain the personal depth experiences, shaping goals and desires, and contain the essence on which life depends. Let me now read you the ending of the fairy tale. At last the king came home again from his journey, and his first wish was to see his wife and child. Then his aged mother began to weep and said, "You wicked man, why did you write to me that I was to take those two innocent lives?" And she showed him the two letters which the evil one had forged, and then continued, "I did as you bade me," and she showed the tokens of the tongue and the eyes. Then the king began to weep for his poor wife and his little son so much more bitterly than what she was doing. The aged mother had compassion on him and said, "Be at peace, she still lives. I secretly caused a hind to be killed and took these tokens from it. But I bound the child to your wife's back and bade her go forth into the wide world and made her promise never to come back here again because you were so angry with her." Thereupon, the king traveled about for 7 long years. See, it's a gorgeous fairy tale because the masculine has to do an equal amount of struggling, And sought her in every cleft of the rocks and in every cave, but he found her not and thought she had died of want. During the whole of this time, he neither ate nor drank, but God supported him. At length he came into a great forest and found therein the little house whose sign was, "Hear all, dwell free." Then forth came the white maiden, took him by the hand, led him in, and said, "Welcome, king, here is your wife, and that is your son, Sorrowful." Interesting name. And he saw her living hands and said, "My wife had silver hands." And she answered, "The good God has caused my natural hands to grow again." And the angel went into the inner room and brought the silver hands and showed them to him. Thereupon he knew for a certainty it was his dear wife and dear child. He kissed them and was glad and said, "A heavy stone has fallen off my heart." Then the angel of God ate with them once again, and after that they went home to the king's aged mother. It's an interesting return, too. There were great rejoicings everywhere, and the king and queen were married again and lived contentedly to their happy end. I'm not finished yet, though. Okay. Just a couple more here. But you know what this one's got a happy ending to it, doesn't it? Not all the fairy tales have happy endings, but this one does, considering where the fairy tale has kind of gone through. So, the 7 years that the king goes through, and also that the queen has had to experience alone, denote a number of initiation and transformation, really to the max, which, of course, both of them had to undergo. And it's interesting that the king does not recognize her. She's really been very much changed through her experiences, and in the process has escaped possession by the negative father complex. The angel really was the messenger and a connecting link between past, present, and future, and shows him the silver hands. She's the one that's going to show the proof and link it all together. It is noted that the maiden retained her faith, piety, and respect, which were the qualities which initially kept the devil at bay. So what she did at the beginning really worked for her all the way through. When the king finds the maiden, the name of their son is revealed as Sorrowful, and the suffering has been given meaning in being named, demonstrating a differentiation and validation of the experiences which were endured, and recognizing the freedom in release from a previous state of unconsciousness. The pain in change and growth has been transformed, and the maiden and the king now return to life. The maiden has attained her own hands and can go with life rather than be at the mercy of it. The devil has served his purpose, and the animus need not be evil and destructive, but can function as a partner in life. The masculine and feminine principles can hold hands and work together, but in a different way than the first time, and that's why they have to get remarried. Because the remarriage signifies the healing of the deep dissociation of these opposites which were formerly torn apart. Psychological wholeness entails inclusion of the contrasexual aspects with the vitality, enrichment, and individuation evolving as each one must relate to the other one. When the masculine entity has become integrated into the personality, a change of attitude occurs to foster creativity and individuality. And of course, they eat together at the end, symbolizing a consummation and reunion. The fairy tale shows that the animus problem needs time and involves suffering. The girl never returns to the father, demonstrating a situation when the complex has such a powerful hold that it requires a total separation. By facing reality, a woman avoids allowing herself to be blindly possessed, and the animus can serve her feminine aims as the energies from unconscious contents are mediated through the ego in validation of her innate knowledge. Jung says the destructive power is converted into healing forces. This is brought about by the archetypes awakening to independent life and taking over the guidance of the psychic personality, thus supplanting the ego with its futile willing and striving. There are, of course, many more symbols in this fairy tale, but enumerating on them all leads us far astray from the subject, which is the cutting off and regrowth of the maiden's hands. And hands are symbolic in this fairy tale and for women coming to terms with conscious use of the animus and its relation to the feminine principle. To know the animus, yet not be possessed by it, takes a journey like that of the maiden in the fairy tale. Being a woman takes hands connected to the creative source from within. By staying in touch with the forces of her nature and by learning to stand her ground, a helpful animus can emerge. But when the connection causes unrelenting questioning, anguish, despair, and a feeling of not being good enough, then you know that the animus is in control. Or when a woman tries to approach the creative in a willful way, she will be lost. It takes a wandering around, a feeling from the inside out, and an openness for this whole process to evolve. This sounds like a process of birth, showing that for the feminine, development of creative endeavors is a birth involving isolation, change, and reconnection between the body and the psyche. Regaining of spirit is not accomplished by techniques, nor by forcing the issue, but is a process of sacrifice with increasing awareness that fosters the growth of the feminine principle. And I'd like to end with a quote from Martin Buber, who says, "But because being here amounts to so much, because all this here and now, so fleeting, seems to require us and strangely concerns us, the most fleeting of all. Just once, everything, only for once, once and no more, and we too, once and never again. But this having been once on earth, can it ever be canceled? And so we keep pressing on and trying to perform it, trying to contain it within our simple hands, in the more and more crowded gaze, in the speechless heart, trying to become it." I want to thank you for your attention, and I believe we have, 10 or 15 minutes break. I wonder if I can't get this on. So the fairy tales were very much alive in the culture, and when they were written down as anything that we write down, it changed. You know, when you write your dreams down, you change them, don't you? can't tell you the amount of times people have come to me for analysis and they'll say, well, I wrote this down and I left off. It's what's interesting is what's left off, and we might say that also about the fairy tales, you know, what really was left off, as well as how many people believe that fairy tales really should not be told to children because they're too brutal. But actually they tell us about life, you know, very practical things. Have water around when there's the devil, how you kind of draw this chalk circle around yourself. I think children are not as afraid of the unconscious because they're much closer to it than we as adults. And so the children really will not be harmed by the fairy tales. They'll be harmed by what's going on in the family much more than by the fairy tales. And they will understand the meaning in the fairy tales a lot. I think what is interesting, too, that you might think about is what is your own favorite fairy tale. Because that will tell you a lot about your life. Think about it. It's pretty... favorite fairy tale from when you were little, you know. You might contemplate that, about what comes up, and what does it really tell you about who you are and what you are going to accomplish or need to accomplish in your life. It's like the first dream in analysis, really. It tells you what's going to happen in that particular process. Lay it out very clearly. Anybody else have a question? Yes?
I have a question about a reference to
I think it was from projection and recollection. Yes, that was projection and recollection.
Okay.
Right. Yes.
About the woman, how is the woman in the tale sure that she sees the giant? That is, who has come to ask for what is behind the father?
The mother noticed. The mother knew it was the devil. Is that what you're referring to?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, because she had experienced this kind of, you know, you're getting something for nothing. You can't really get something for nothing. If you've ever tried it, you know that it's not going to work. So she knows. And the other thing is that what is interesting is the amount that she really knows about what's going on and doesn't protect the daughter. It's very typical of incestuous families. Not just incestuous families, but we could use kind of any psychological thing that's going on that mom knows. Now, this is not only the mother, dad might too, but in this particular example, that the mother knows what's going on and colludes with it and doesn't do anything to protect or stop or help at all, but just continues the process. So it's what can happen in a family, and this is part of that participation mystique, where the mother knows but doesn't say anything. One of the damaging things about participation mystique is the amount of secrets and silence that there is around it. So what would have happened if the mother at the beginning had blown the whistle on the whole situation and had run out and said, wait a second, that's the devil who's making a bargain with you. Would you watch and don't do that? Or it's the daughter who's behind the apple tree. It's not just an apple tree. But then, of course, we could add to that and say, why was the father not more careful? Why didn't he know where his daughter was? Why didn't he observe? Why wasn't he aware consciously of where she might have been in relation to him? That's really what it is, isn't it? It's the daughter's behind the tree. Why doesn't he know where she is in relation to him? It really tells us about the value of the father knowing where the girl child is. Certainly he should know where the boy child is, but where the girl child is. It's his own undifferentiated part. Yes, absolutely. It's like what I had said, that he wounds from his place of woundedness. Now that continues on through generations, unless the differentiation starts to happen or unless what that means is as one becomes conscious, then it does not have to go through the generations. But we all inherit a certain amount of this kind of unconsciousness, secret silence of the family. We all know our family secrets, right? Or if you have children or grandchildren or whatever, and they're this tall, they'll tell you the family secrets. All you have to do is ask them. And they are smart enough to say what's going on. Unfortunately, we grow older and we don't say. We just learn to shut our mouths. And the breaking of participación mystique is opening up your mouth. And then, of course, part of that means that it isn't so happy anymore. Not that it necessarily was, but it breaks the spell of an illusion of what one had perceived to be going on that maybe was not even really true, but only became true because we conjectured that that's the way mom or dad was. Yes. Right, it also relates to her going through. Is that okay? It also relates to her going through puberty, doesn't it? So the mill, really, I think I said it relates to generativity. So it's like she's behind there and maybe a bit unconscious also of the danger. So she's in the present, she's in her own future, she's also in her past. The mill represents that. I think the apple tree does too. I didn't speak much about the symbol of the apple tree, which is really a symbol of love, isn't it? And the seeds inside of the apple is growth. We could go into the apple tree a lot too. Or the Garden of Eden, that apple was pretty important. So that's part of it too. Did I answer what you were getting at? Right. Right. Do you remember I mentioned that she went along with the situation? She colluded with saying, sure, chop off my hands. So there, you're right, there's something very wrong that we sense even at that very beginning paragraph in this family. Mm-hmm. You make some good points there. Yes. Yes. Well, you're right. It sounded like that. But he is another part of the animus who has healed himself by going through the 7 years of searching for her, and he has changed. And actually, he started out as quite a nice figure in a way, didn't he? Because he was going to protect her, he would take care of her, he had silver hands made, so he helped her out. So, you know, and he brought her in and didn't treat her badly. So he was already a helpful animus figure and developed even more into one when they separated and he had to go and find her. Yes, so he is an inside helpful animus, as well as maybe a shift in the collective attitude of the masculine in relation to the feminine. We might be experiencing such a shift now. We might have a good king around, or king like this. Yes? Well, if you think about it, any psychological growth involves an abandonment. In other words, a leaving or being abandoned from the way that we thought it should be or the path that we were going on. One has to abandon it, leave it, be told that you can't continue on it. Well, I want to pose a question. Are you sure? Isn't it a mutual, yeah, an inside process that's going on within her that's also having all of these outside influences acting in a certain way? The abandonment, I use the word betrayal, abandonment also, are really necessary for her growth and development. What's going on outwardly is reflecting the inside process and vice versa. Yes. Well, you know, it's like she has to go, that's what I was referring to about this introversion. Even though she united with the king, had the baby, it's almost like she had to go back and be virginal again and be maiden again and be isolated. For 7 years, she had to stay away and alone. It was amazing. When I was doing this, someone that I was working with said that she had been isolated for 7 years. It was just the exact amount of time. I thought, my goodness. I said, what do you mean? She said, I've stayed out of life. And now I'm ready to go back into it. It was like something that was, I had thought, well, maybe this is just a fairy tale in a sense. You know, this kind of 7 years, a large chunk of time. But think about how long you might need to be isolated away. And you can't really be with somebody because it's an inside process. You've got to get out of that and get back into being a maiden. It shows the value of maidenhood. She would probably be associated with Artemis because of the age of the maiden. Right. And Artemis, of course, the Greek goddess, never unites with any kind of man. Keeps them completely at a distance. She might be a little bit like the Puella also, or the female part, which is not yet developed. So she is with the king, has the child, marries, etc., but then has to go away. And then the process is repeated. Remember, they get remarried at the end. So it's kind of, she's got to go through it twice. Yes? Oh, are you saying it would be exclusive? I mean, that mutually exclusive, like we wouldn't have to be introverted. Is that what you're asking? Oh, God. Uh-huh. Oh, how does it happen culturally? Good point. Does anybody have an idea? How does it happen culturally? Does it happen culturally? I don't know if it's happening culturally. So maybe what you're saying is that one can be out there, and then, of course, there has to be a time when one goes inside. But is that happening culturally? Even though Gloria Steinem wrote that book, is that happening culturally? Yes? Right. In other words, in a sense, maybe all the football games and all this kind of extroverted stuff of our culture can be there for a certain amount of people. And then another certain amount of people might do some inside work. And that will help kind of send sparks out to kind of everybody. You know, I wish I could answer your question because it's a great one, but then I would be kind of a seer into the future. I really don't know what to say.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.